Good morning. A memory has been very persistent in the last week while I've been here, so I've decided to share this story from my life. And I think it's coming up because of this. There is a path through which the opening of all things returns to the person in Zazen, and the person and the enlightenment of all things intimately and imperceptibly assist each other. So this mutual assistance, this giving and receiving that's constantly happening, but sometimes we don't perceive it. Sometimes we do perceive it. But mostly, I don't think we realize the interdependence that's happening at every moment, which is why we do this sesshin, because we can open up a little bit to this miraculous functioning that's happening all the time. We can begin to see it, and that affects our whole life. So I have a story about this. The reason I didn't want it to bring it up is because it's when I went to Auschwitz-Birkenau with Bernie Glassman. And I'd rather not remember that. And I don't like bringing it up for others. But anyway, we're bringing it up today. I think Bernie's instructions, the three tenets of the Buddhist Peacemaker's Order, are just wonderful instructions on how to practice Buddhism. I can't think of better instructions. And those three tenets, you know, we've been talking about this for 20 years, but anyway, we're going to repeat them. One is to start with don't know mind. The second is to bear witness. And the third is to do some kind of action. In Bernie's later years, he said loving action or compassionate action. So the don't know mind, I think, is what we've been studying somewhat this week. What is an unfabricated mind? What is a mind that has let go of our opinions, let go of our agendas, and is just open to receiving what is? And often with that mind, I don't know what to do, really. I'm just receiving. And it's very hard not to have an agenda. An agenda for sesshin, agenda for my own personal growth, an agenda for clouds and water, an agenda for my children, an agenda for my marriage, an agenda for my brothers. It's very hard to let those go, because all those our agendas are made from our small mind of greed, anger, and ignorance, for the most part. And I said for the most part, but in the name of Buddhism, we've done a lot of bad agendas in the name of all religions. So even so-called do-gooder agendas often have created evil. I've been thinking about evil. I know that you changed the word evil in the meal chant. I've been thinking about that. Because I think Christians have a lot of backlog on the word evil. And maybe Jews do too, but I don't particularly. But sometimes the level of harm, I think it's okay to call evil. I mean, it's not a demon or a devil. It's human greed, anger, and ignorance gone to an extreme. So, for example, when I was at Auschwitz-Birkenau, I was mainly at Birkenau, which is the larger of the concentration camps. I really felt like that greed, anger, and ignorance had gone into the realm of evil. So I'm going to stay with the word evil in our meal chant. There's a great, wonderful, funny, short koan about Don't Know Mind that I loved since I was 16. A professor comes to see a Zen teacher to have a discussion. A professor. So professor is an expert in ideas and opinions and studying and intelligence. And he comes, and the Zen teacher said, let's have tea. And as the Zen teacher is pouring tea for the professor, he pours, and he doesn't stop pouring until the tea cup is overflowing and the tea's going all over the floor. And the professor says, wait, what are you doing? Stop. And he said, well, in order for me to pour tea, there has to be an empty cup, meaning that you have to find an unfabricated mind. You have to let go of all your opinions and everything you've read. So that's the don't know mind. The thing we don't like about don't know mind is human beings like security and stability. And a don't know mind is not secure. Right? It's just, Pema Chodron calls it groundless. It's not grounded. It's anything could happen. So I think in my life, and I'm not over learning this, how to be more comfortable with uncertainty, which is the name of one of Pema Chodron's books. I can't remember what the title is, but it has those words in it. Bearing witness is really hard to do, as we all have been bearing witness to our own suffering in Sesshin, and bearing witness to other people's suffering, and then thinking about people's suffering, my children, my husband, Clouds and Water, the people at Clouds and Water, the people who left. I mean, it's endless, really. Once your self-contained little world breaks open, the suffering is everywhere. This is what Buddha said. Suffering is everywhere. So one of our practices, and we've certainly been practicing it here this week, is to sit down with suffering and be able to be close and not run away. This is called bearing witness. Reb has often called it being able to go really, really close and sit down and be intimate without doing anything. He recommended that for people for caregivers, for the sick and dying, just go and sit as close as you can to the suffering and don't do anything. That's bearing witness. And he said that imperceptively will help the person. So somehow our bearing witness to our own suffering and others' suffering while we're sitting zazen imperceptibly helps the world. Imperceptibly helps us grow into a person who could go to Africa and work with the children with the flies all by their eyes. Suffering that's beyond imagining. And patience, one of the paramitas, it's one of the great paramitas. And I have to learn it. I'm learning it every day, how to be more settled with the way things are. That's kind of patience. Katagiri used to say, it's not this kind of patience. You know, waiting for it to be over. It's the kind of right acceptance, samadhi, where you're deeply patient with samsara. Because samsara goes on endlessly. It's not going to stop while you're alive, at least we know that. it goes on endlessly. So the answer to it is this very deep, radical patience, bearing witness. And I feel that our best activity comes from bearing witness to the suffering of the situation. And then from that place, without an agenda in the mind, without my opinion about what my son should do, for example, but to stay with my son and his suffering. And then if I can feel it, sometimes, oh, we should go to the movies, comes up. Or, I should encourage him to call that person. Something comes up not from my opinion, but from the actuality of the experience of the moment. That's the way I would like to live. So those are Bernie's instructions. He calls what he does taking plunges. And I think he got it from Sishin, that you plunge in to the unconscious material, the unknown, you're out of control, you go deep, you don't know what's happening, you don't know how to get out, really. You took a plunge when you came to Sishin. And I think you always take a plunge. And I always am right nervous before I come to Sishin. I'm always nervous because I know I'm taking a plunge. So going to Auschwitz-Birkenau is a plunge. You plunge into something that is unfathomable. And I'm not going to go through the whole story. I just want to tell you about the last day. Mostly I cried for 3 or 4 days, uncontrollable crying. So I had been cleansed in a certain way. I had really digested something in the beginning of the retreat, 3 or 4 days of retreat. Then the last day, I decided not to do the schedule and to put on my Okeso, which I hadn't worn yet. It was quite cold, so I put my Okeso on top of my winter coat and everything. And I decided to do what I came there to do. So, which was to pray for the people who died there. And I had just been studying Tonglen. So that's what I wanted to do. But I couldn't do it in the beginning because I was too involved with my own reaction to being there. So I was kind of clear. I had cried for 3 or 4 days. And I said, okay, you're going to do what you came here to do, to broaden my Tonglen. Do you know what Tonglen is? Breathing in, okay. The suffering and breathing out freedom or release or love. So I did walking meditation almost all day, just walking around the grounds. And they're huge. I mean, that's what freaks you out too. It's a huge facility of death. And I walked around, and for the morning, I just did my Tonglen, every step, breathing in how much suffering I could breathe in, and breathing out, wishing kindness to all the people who died here, that the world wouldn't do this again, those kind of thoughts. And there was one point in the afternoon where I realized that this in and out thing wasn't happening. Even though I was doing the Tonglen, something else was happening, which was I had heard before I went to Auschwitz on this retreat, people had talked about that the angels sing at Auschwitz. Now, I like the word angels, but if you don't like that word, you could say invisible beings. And Buddhism is surrounded, you know, there's a lot of invisible beings in Buddhism. You know, just read any sutra, and there's 64,000 invisible beings listening to this lecture, right? So I'm going to call them angels, though. Excuse me for calling, not saying invisible beings or bodhisattvas or some Buddhist word. And all of a sudden, I realized that the invisible beings that were present at this camp 50 years later were healing me. So my in-breath was, well, I was taking in the suffering, but I was receiving this beautiful healing from the environment. And on my out-breath, both was happening, out and in. So there was no out and there was no in. It was completely merged. And I was being healed in this place of terrible suffering. And it just completely turned my mind around about in and out and receiving and giving. And it reminds me of this sutra that you don't know what's happening. It's just completely happening. And there's no differentiation between you and the environment or good and bad or receiving and giving. It was all completely one. It was a gift that I received from the risk of going there. So that's a little bit similar to Zazen in a way. So one other thing about that is not everything happens in the Zendo. That was experience that happened outside the Zendo. But I felt that it was completely connected with my Zazen. A, I was concentrated enough to even do that practice of walking around. And it came from the wisdom or from the experience of having had many, many sessions prior to going there. And I really don't even think I could have gone if I didn't have the stability of Sishin behind me to know how to handle a plunge like that. So what I think Dogen is saying also and is that we can't consciously do this. I don't know what happened there. It was really beyond my intellectual linear thinking. And I think Zazen is very similar to that. You really don't know what's going on. Even when you have a clear mind, you don't know what's going on. And there's a power, this imperceptible, invisible, functioning, the Buddha work, the functioning of the Buddha work is what transforms you. So it's not that I sit in Zazen and I change myself and I do this and I do that. I'm not into that anymore because my eye is too stupid, too puny, too self-centered, too full of ego, of greed, anger, and ignorance. All three of them. So I don't know what the heck I'm doing. But there's a power in just doing it. So that's the Dharma wheel taking care of you. You know, we do something by coming. We do something by our practice. But I really think that the transformation comes from just sitting. I'd like to mostly talk about what it means going beyond Buddha. So that little phrase is kind of throughout the whole Jujyu Zammai. What does it mean to go beyond Buddha? We're all trying to get Buddha, mostly. Very greedily, if I may add. Greed for Buddha is the same as greed for anything. I like to tell myself that because I am still, and boy, my life has been totally about greed. Getting more of the Dharma, understanding more, having better zazen, blah, 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 blah. But it's still greed. It's still coming from a very self-centered place. So I'm trying, I am working quite now to let go of that when I see it arise. And to say, this moment is enough. This is the enlightenment at hand. This is it. That's a famous Buddhist line. This is it, just this. So I think going beyond Buddha, it's a little bit like the phrase, kill the Buddha. If you see the Buddha on the road, kill the Buddha. It's not enough. I just said everything was enough. So I'm being paradox. I'm being like Dogen. In the same sentence, saying the opposites. Yay. Yay for paradox. Oh, that's part of don't know mine, right? There's always an essential paradox that you can never figure out. So don't try. Stop figuring it out. Doesn't help you. Actually, it hinders you because then your mind is just circle, circle, circle around a paradox. You can't figure it out. So let go of it. And trust, or have faith, as we talked about before. Faith that accepting the present moment is enough. But when we have an experience and get a glimmer of what we think is Buddha, so there's a lot in that, right? Think. Oh man, do we want to hold on to it. Freedom. Freedom from suffering and bliss maybe, or what are the three signs? Profound stillness, illumination, everything illuminated, and rapture in the body. It's very attractive to us suffering beings. Freedom. And we do want an experience of that, or we wouldn't be doing this. I like to call Sishin a cockamamie thing. I don't know if that's Yiddish or not, but kind of a crazy thing. Sometimes I think about if aliens came from, they would say, George, did you see those people? They just sit all day and don't do anything. There's just a few of them, though. So what is it that, of course, we're trying to get liberated from our greed, anger, and ignorance. We're trying to get a taste of this Buddha work, this circulation, as Dokai pointed out yesterday, this interdependence, total, complete. Now I sound like Dogen too. Ceaseless, incomprehensible, total, complete circulation of the Buddha function. And we want to awaken to the fact that we're a part of it. Not separate. We're completely a part of the Buddha function seamlessly. So we like to wake up to it. But once we do, there's a few problems that come up. And these are called Zen sicknesses or emptiness sickness. And Okamura Roshi had three things that described Zazen illness. One was attachment to Zazen and what I just described, the states. Two was that you still have inverted views, even though you've seen interconnection, but you still have upside down views based on greed, anger, and ignorance. And third is you get very arrogant and you're better than everyone else because you've seen something that no ordinary person has seen. So we would like to go beyond this. Not fall into sickness, and to go beyond a nesting place. Dosho often talked about making yourself a nest. That's one of the things I remember of his teaching. He said, don't make a nest in your Buddhahood. So can you just, I've been watching this bird in a nest, but you know, just making a nest and being so happy to be sitting there and not moving and not creating too much karma because you're not talking, you're not doing anything, you're just sitting. So we don't want to make a nest. It's almost a death. In a way, a death of your humanness, to want to retreat or hide out in no karmic consciousness. And I think perhaps for some Buddhists that is a proper, you know, to distinguish the light, you know. But in Mahayana Buddhism, which is our sect, and particularly with Dogen, he's really not into that. He self receive use oneness. The use part means that we get out of our nest, and we work in the world of form. In the world of desire, we might be rid of most of our desires, but we work for all the other people. This is going beyond Buddha, going beyond getting stuck on your pillow in the zendo. And we don't want to. Why don't we want to? Because everyone's suffering. So if you don't have good bearing witness, you're not going to be able to do it, to go. You just want to retreat. I'll go back to Hokyoji and sit in the Zendo. I don't want to hear people getting divorced. You know, all the things you hear. There's many, many things. So going beyond Buddha means we go beyond Buddha. We go back into the world with our knowledge and with our karma consciousness coming back. You know, when I walk through the door of my house, my children and my sons don't know that I've had a transformative experience. They're just the same, you know, they treat me the same. I get right away, the things come up almost right away. I get hooked by the same old, same old. This is going beyond Buddha. And then going beyond Buddha is, oh man, you have to work lifetime after lifetime after lifetime to do that right, to go back into the world and not be led by greed, anger, and ignorance. That's the 52 stages of a bodhisattva. There are 52 stages, and they take eons to perfect. That's the opposite of sudden enlightenment, is, oh, then we have to go back and we have to practice in many different ways in order to, function in the world as a helping person and also to free all beings, which is our vow. Not just free me. So there's a koan about this stepping off the 100-foot pole, Book of Serenity 79. So Okamura Roshi called this climbing up the pole. So it's ascending and descending in spiritual life. You can sit at the top of the pole in a perfect nest like an eagle, like an eagle's nest at the top of the pole, and you're completely satisfied. And everything's just dandy, your zazen is good, you're not thinking too much, so nothing seems to bother you. Maybe you have a little rapture in the body, or maybe nothing. Nothing's nice too. Just completely disengaged. I love it. Charlie says the reason I'm a Zen person was because it was so loud in my family of origin. Everyone yelling at each other, and aggression everywhere. And all I wanted to do when I was 18 and left the house was be quiet. And so here I am. This is what Okmura said. We go back and forth in the using of enlightenment. We climb up the pole and deepen our understanding, and then we have to jump off the pole to put it to use, to engage in the world, to implement our commitments to be of use in the world. If we don't jump off, our enlightenment is sort of self-indulgent. And from the, I'm not going to go into the whole jumping off a 100-foot pole koan, but there's a few things that really I'm going to bring up forth for us. Oh, it's so late already. So this was a poem that's embedded in the koan, Shangsa's poem. So the whole poem, Shangsa, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that name right, so forgive me if I'm butchering it. Shangsa sent a monk to question a hermit. So a hermit was kind of a person on the top of the 100-foot pole, isolated from society and just sitting. And he had a good sense of emptiness, right? But this is a poem that was somewhere in the commentary. The man sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though he's gained entry, this is not yet the real. Atop the 100-foot pole, he should step forward. The universe in all directions is the whole body. That's jumping off the pole and knowing that the whole situation is my body. Another one that was really interesting was the commentator wrote, once we have a glimpse of the Buddha, we put it like a treasure in a glass jar. And he said, it's like having your eyeballs in a glass jar. And how would you take care of this glass jar, you know? And the commentator said, like gathering all your treasures and putting them in a glass jar and guarding them as if they were your eyeballs. Don't let me see that. I'd surely pick it up and smash it, making your hands free. Folks, joyfully alive with no taboos. So because you're holding your treasure, you don't have hands to help to live. So get rid of that treasure that you're holding and go back to the world joyfully alive. With no taboos. I think, what does that mean, no taboos? It's kind of like the religious taboos, like you can't drink, you can't gossip, you can't do so much renunciation in a spiritual life. But I think in the end, you want to really join in with life. That's going beyond Buddha. And that's what Katagiri, what I remember most about the last years of Katagiri Roshi's teaching, and I was there. A lot of people had already gone to Japan or other places or were in fights with him and had left. I was the last Eno, so I was there right near the end. Often his lectures, he would just lean over and say, just live. Just live your life. That's what Buddhism is about. This is very similar. I'd smash it, making your hands free. Folks, joyfully alive with no taboos. Okay, so I want to continue with this idea of jumping off the nest of enlightenment, or whatever we conceive of, I don't know what we're doing. We talked about the original face, which is kind of what we're all searching for, to taste that thing that never dies, to drop off body and mind, all of our tainted views. I'm trying to get some of the language that the Jijiyu Zama uses, not stained by defilement, not karmic, just open and free and incomprehensible, and all those adjectives. That's what we often clothe the original face with, those kind of adjectives. And really, it's pretty much nothing except life. So I looked up in the Ehe Koroku, which was written near the end of his life, those lectures. So I think the Ehe Koroku is a cool book. And now, if you don't have the paperback has an index. You should get the index. You can look up original face, and they tell you what page these little Dharma talks are. So I got one little Dharma talk about the original face. You know, in a way, I think Dogen, in his older years, was quite cynical. He really wanted to smash the standard line that the Buddhists were taking, that Zen was taking. Like, I'd smash that treasure with the eyeballs in it so that you could be free to really engage with your life, not holding back because you have the eyeballs, you know, or you have a sense of emptiness in your heart or something. Anyway, listen to this one. At first, I didn't get it, and I was so shocked. But as I've been sitting with it, I really am enjoying it now. This was entitled The Nightingale Tune and the Hollow Man. It's number 57. What is the mind of the ancient Buddhas? That's the question. So also, what is the original face? I would say to someone, the song of the nightingale is the same everywhere. What is the original person? I would say to someone, an emaciated man with withered skin. Now, doesn't that flip you around? You weren't expecting a kind of negative image of the original person. What is the mind of the ancient Buddhas? I would say to someone, the song of the nightingale is the same everywhere. What is the original person? I would say to someone, an emaciated man with withered skin. So I entitled this The Twist, Dogen's Twist Around the Original Face, because in Jijiyu Zama, he uses it as a positive. You know, that's what we're looking for. In most of Buddhism, they use it as most studies of original faces used positively. And in this case, I think he's bringing up the attachment to the original face and saying, if you don't jump off the 100-foot pole, if you just live in your nest, detached from the world, not engaging in your karmic consciousness, just being quiet and open and free, which sounds delightful. If we do that, will end up being an emaciated person with withered skin, right? We won't eat. We won't go to the grocery store. We won't have love in our life. We won't make babies. We won't cry. We won't laugh. We won't do anything, right? We'll just be in the hermitage with nothing on our mind. I think this is what is meant by going beyond Buddha. Going beyond Buddha means we don't get attached to this rarefied situation. That we understand that we can take the beauty and the interdependence that we discover through being our highest self, through experiencing a Buddha. And then we go back into our life and do the 52 fucking stages. I wanted to use a strong word because we have so much work to do in that arena, right? To be a, what?
Limitless
work. To every day say, I vow to notice my greed, to notice my hate, to notice when I'm not working interdependently, and I'm going to put an end to it. Well, that is an endless proposition. And it's a beautiful thing to take on. That's playing with the mud balls, saying, okay, they say greed, anger, and ignorance arises endlessly, and I vow to interrupt it. I like the word interrupt better than end it. End it sounds like once and for all you can end it. But I don't think that's true. You might get better at noticing it and letting it go and switching your agenda. You might get better at that, but it comes up. Someone do something and I see my So then, now, especially in Sesshin, usually I can say, oh, that's anger arisen. Are you going to keep it going? You know, you can really keep it going. You can sit on that cushion and keep it going for hours if you choose to. Or you can practice letting go the thoughts and sitting with the until it releases itself. It will release itself if we bear witness to it. We don't have to hardly do anything except bear witness to it. And isn't that what I think Buddha said? The awareness itself is the healing. But it's very hard to stay with my greed, my anger, and my selfishness. To really say, okay, I notice this. It's kind of similar, the emaciated man with withered skin is a little bit similar, and I always say this story around this time in Sesshin. I think I say it repeatedly, but it's a good story. It's the one about the guy saying, you know, my samadhi is so good, I could die on the cushion. I could just leave. And so the other student says, oh, that's, you know, that's all right. Well, is that true? You know, he didn't know what to say. Are you going to do that or what? So the guy actually did. He sat down on the cushion and he died. So the other student comes up. You know, they do die in the stories anyway, in their Zazen posture, upright, some of the great masters. And he came over and he taps the person on the head, the dead person now, on the shoulder, and said, I'm so sorry. you didn't understand our teacher's words at all. That's the withered man with the emaciated man with withered skin. I was assuming it was the dead one. So one of the koans about maybe not. Well, there's another koan about it, about the worms. This is at the end of, he talks about the cutting the worms in two at the end of Busho, Buddha Nature. Do you remember? Because Shohaku talked quite a bit about this one. And the reason I'm reading it is it's one of the koans about original person. And it's also a koan with this twist in it that it's ignorance to hold on to the original face is the theme of this one. So I'm not going to explain the whole thing, but I want to get to the sentence and then what to Dogen comment on. This is also from Ehe Koroku. Actually, I think there were three entries on the worm koan in Ehe Koroku. Here is a story. A government minister, so this is someone who has a big job in the government, asked Xuanzha, or Jing Sen, he's in our lineage, isn't he, Jing Sen? But anyway, I didn't look that up. When an earthworm is cut into two, I wonder which piece has the Buddha nature. Xuanzha said, don't have deluded thoughts. That was the answer. The offer said, what about when both pieces are moving? Changsa said, that is only because the wind and fire has not yet dispersed. And after further discussion, Changsa said, ignorant people call this the original person. Ignorant people call this, and then in parentheses they have, the consciousness that is the root source of life and death, the original person. And then what Dogen commented was, the root of life and death from beginningless ages is what ignorant people call the original person. Even though they turn upside down and disseminate their views in the process, the great earth, mountains, and rivers are still the pure body. So I think what this is saying to me again is, if we say that emptiness is the original face, or the source of everything, we have just dissected the world into two, emptiness and form, again, and again, and again. The minute we say original face is only emptiness, we've dissected the world into two, form and emptiness. And I think this is the subtle method, the subtle teaching that has been directly handed down from generation to generation, that's from the beginning of the Jijiyu Zanmai, This subtlety about not clinging to one side or the other side, but seeing them as a whole, W-H-O-L-E, that are simultaneous, always together, that the imputational character, the cause and effect character, the suchness character are always manifesting together. That's the subtle part that's hard to get. Not dissecting it into two. If you dissect it into two, then you reify sitting zazen and finding your original face. And you downplay driving your son to school. But that's not the teaching. The teaching is that in every moment, all of it occurs. And that's what Dogen is saying. The pure body is the form of the moment. There's no original face separate from the form of the moment. They completely are together. The great earth, mountains, and rivers are still the pure body. There isn't an original face outside of the earth, mountains, and rivers. Yeah? This is the point. That the imputational character is not bad. It's not what we're trying to get rid of. It's a part of it. And you can't pull those apart. They're glued together. Which makes it easier to know how to practice. Because you just practice with whatever in front of your nose. That's the enlightenment at hand. That's the original face with a certain clothes on it. You know, Katagiri runs, now I might be wrong, but I remember this really strongly, and it was here at Hokyoji. He was talking about Tathagata Garba. And I remember he said it was the clothes of the original face. The form that it came in was like the clothes. And I remember, because I remembered it, garb. It was the garb. Now, I don't think garba means that, but that's how I remembered it. So that's how we live in the present moment, is that every event is it. And we see it wholly, W-H-O-L-E. So does anybody want to say anything about, about anything, but what is the mind of the ancient Buddha? I would say to someone, the song of the nightingale is the same everywhere. What is the original person? I would say to someone, an emaciated person with withered skin. Did that bring up anything for anybody?
That is the original face. That old man, the emaciated face, the old woman, that person of the part of us that has borne and continues to bear all the world's suffering from all our lives.
So that's switching it around again.
It's not something that glows like some bright moon. It's some thing that's suffered for endless ages.
Emaciated man reminds me of Shakyamuni, you know, when he was practicing asceticism and all those statues where he's just
ribs.
And that would fit with what other people have been saying. That is the place where he's seeking and he's at war with his body, and you know, he's in delusion, even though he's highly skilled at a number of things. So still there is the original thing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then how hard it must have been for him to accept the rice water or the rice porridge after that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, that would be free of taboo, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that he was only supposed to have berries and things he could forage. Do you get that connection I just made?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I was more of the persuasion like Dan when you read the story.
Mm-hmm.
About the original face, the withered, the initiated in that withered skin. I just said, yeah. And it's like, it's directly that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can look at it from various perspectives.
Right.
As someone maybe who got worn out by maybe the idea of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. On the other hand, that's kind of how we might all die. So how would we just be that withered, emaciated person with withered skin?
Mm-hmm.
We make that exactly our original face, because we don't imagine us being that.
Right.
Imagine some glowing being that will be when we die and be worshipped and people surrounded by disciples weeping, crying, and things like that. But maybe we'll be
sitting up there. No one even knew he was gone. So I love that there was a twist to how I was presenting in another way is just, oh, that too. That's a Vipassana practice. Just saying that this too. Even if you don't like it, you know, like we wouldn't like to be a withered, emaciated person. But this, too, is the original face.
But I was thinking there'd be freedom in that. If I, like, recognize, like, I'm like an emaciated old woman with what kind of skin?
Withered.
Withered. It's very traumatic. It's like, okay. Just sit with that. And I just start relaxing into it. It's like, oh man, that is free. Because all the judgment around being emaciated and being withered, the dharmas, the 10,000 dharmas start coming at me. I'm like, oh, receive, open. And pretty soon it's like, wow, this is not bad. Because if I start here, and go out from this place of openness. This is cool. But if I come from a place where I'm like, ooh, this is a bummer, man. I can't stand myself. And I know other people won't be able to. I mean, that's real suffering. But like, wow. So I'm like, I'm into it.
Oh, being a withered old person, right? Or having...
Because then it's like, in that, it's like there's the original face, dropping off body and mind.
Agenda, certainly, dropping off. Mm-hmm. And also no preference. I mean, we have an aversive to emaciated, withered, but that too. So, you want to say one more?
For me, it's all earth. That this earth, water, air, and fire, and it's that, you know, we're a bipedal kind of of the earth, and how beautiful it is when we see these fallen rocks and you know, the weathered wood on a tree. And you know, we can accept like the earth.
Hmm. Well, maybe that should be the last word.
May our intention equal